One of my great pleasures on the Little Wireless program over the years has been to chat with the late, great Gore Vidal, hearing him speak without fear or favour about war, empire, religion, sex, and the United States. We also, of course, had frequent contributions from his once anointed Dauphin in Christopher Hitchens. And it was very sad when the two of them fell out. All of memories came rushing back when I was looking at this remarkably good doco on Vidal, Gore Vidal, The United States of Amnesia. And I think it's great that it's been made, because I guess there's an awful lot of younger people who know bugger all about the acerbic novelist and commentator, Mr. Vidal. The director happens to be an Australian, Nicholas Rothel, and he joins me now to talk about what it must have been like to spend time with one of the more intriguing figures of our age. Nicholas, welcome to Late Night Live, and well done.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, Gore, of course, had a passing interest in Australia. I think it was on this very program that he met Bob Carr, for example.
Yes.
But he also had a bit of an interest in Whitlam, didn't he?
He did. You know, I think he considered Bob Carr a bit of a friend, and he'd met Whitlam a few times, and Margaret too, I think, and I think Gough had actually visited him in Ravello.
They're rather alike in many ways, Gough and Gore.
Yeah, I mean, I've never met Gough, but I can see, you know, the comparison. They're both sort of, I guess the old-worldly figures of the left, and, you know, I like to think that Gore was sort of in conversation with Gough and maybe even a bit of a mentor to some people on the left. And I know he spoke to Bob Carr regularly.
Yeah. Well, I remember Bob being on the program with Gore and coming off air and saying it was one of the most wonderful occasions of his life. What drew you to Vidal? Was it, I suppose, you would have enjoyed his spirited response to the Middle Eastern interventions of the United States of Amnesia?
Well, exactly. That was exactly what drew me to him. I was living in New York for a long time in the 90s, and Gore was very outspoken after 9/11. I was there during 9/11, and he seemed to be one of the only voices of reason in the American media landscape at the time, speaking out against the rush to war and you know, the inevitable Bush administration's kind of knee-jerk reaction to the tragedies of the Twin Towers. And, you know, I'd known about Gore for years and read some of his work, but he really sort of grabbed me at that time, and I'm a younger generation, and I started rereading a lot of his essays. And
We're allegedly living through a golden age of television, but for my generation, there was another golden age, and it was when Vidal, Chayefsky, et al. Were writing live-to-air television dramas that were going out, which were absolutely electrifying, and which had the knock-on effect of reviving Hollywood, because so many of these sort of live plays went on to become remarkably powerful feature films.
Yeah, well, I think Gore spent a long time. I think it's something a lot of people don't know so much about Gore, is that he spent a lot of time in Hollywood in the 50s writing those telly plays, as he called them, and you know, that sort of led him into writing films, and that was before he wrote The Best Man and some of his plays as well. And I think he really sort of honed his writing craft in terms of dialogue and the televised material. And at that time, it was a really productive time. He was working on the lot and just writing with a team constantly for years.
I remember Gore Vidal vividly in the prime of life, when he was an endless ball of energy. What you've got are images of him towards the end of his life, when he's overwhelmed by frailty. I've heard the stories before, I know them well, but I haven't heard him tell them with such resonance. Here's a guy looking straight down the barrel of death, and it makes him reconsider and rethink and reevaluate almost everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was lucky to catch him, you know, at that point when he was sort of quite melancholy in a way. His partner Howard had passed away, and he was reflecting, I think, on the state of America, which is what he did throughout his life. But he was really sort of quite pissed off by the Bush administration and really motivated to sort of get out his final words, I think, and really it was excited to have me sort of trailing him around and getting his message out for the final time. I think he was fully aware that he was coming to an end.
As was Christopher Hitchens, because you're filming Christopher when he had weeks really left to live. And so there's a... Anyway, look, there's one of the great zinger lines in the doco. I never heard a patriotic word said by an American soldier about anything. Let's just have a listen to it out of the film.
You can persuade people that to go to war and fight for democracy and die leaving a widow and orphan children behind, that this is serving the greater good. Well, it isn't. It's surrendering to everything evil in the society. But they've been persuaded, oh, it's a noble thing to give your life for your country. Fuck that. I spent 3 years in World War II, the good war. In 3 years in the Pacific, mostly north, but a little bit south, I never heard one patriotic word said by an American soldier about anything.
I find that a very useful observation at the moment when there's so much, well, political theatricality around war. I'm persuaded of the view that very few soldiers are enthusiasts for the project.
And, well, yeah,
but we're told they are.
I think you're absolutely right. And you see it a lot of the time, in these sort of YouTube videos and things of soldiers in Iraq on the front line, just how young and how sort of confused they are or how hyped up they are, but they don't really know what they're getting into. And I think, you know, Gore was a long time pacifist and kind of inherited that from his grandfather in a sense, and as he did many things in his sort of politics and his ethics.
Well, you tell the family history very, very well. And incidentally, I am astonished by the amount of material that you've been able to access. You know, there's tons of stuff with all the combatants, his relationships with Mailer, with...
William F. Buckley, the debates. Yeah, I mean, it was an amazing process for me to have access to this enormous amount of television archives. And fascinating to go through all that material.
We expect these days a public figure to have a vast backlog of stuff, you know, bobbing around the net. But you were dealing with someone who was probably the first person to be as well recorded throughout his public life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Gore had a long sort of life in public. He was almost the first sort of public intellectual and positioned himself very shrewdly over a long period of time on talk shows, on radio, and really, you know, owned the medium and sort of moved from print to sort of mass media in a sense, at the time that the media was changing so quickly.
At the one point, you show wonderful quotes as well as hearing them. You keep whacking them up as graphics, and this is a paraphrase where Gore says, "Never say no to sex or to the invitation to appear on television." But let's go back to this. Tell the story. It comes from an establishment family, not always wealthy, politically well connected. Grandfather a senator, and like his grandson, a man of towering principles. And the film reveals how incredibly alike they were, how many ideals they shared.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the key to Gore's character that I discovered, was that, you know, his sort of ethics and his politics and his beliefs and also his courage to speak out really came to him at a young age from his grandfather. He was sort of his grandfather's page as a young man, taking him to the Senate, reading to him. His grandfather was a very famous blind senator and a famous orator. And, you know, he sat at the table with Huey Long and his grandfather and all these politicians in the 30s in America and learnt sort of firsthand what was going on in D.C.
And coming from this sort of political background, he was always personally interested, you know, in political engagement. At high school, we see him as the class politician. He runs twice for the U.S. Senate, and I'd forgotten the second run. So, but it's almost impossible watching your doco to see him as a career poly, because he really didn't try to make his views particularly palatable, did he?
No, he didn't. He sort of was more of a provocateur. He liked to sort of stir things up, and he'd even say that himself. And he was sort of proud to be, I think, on the edge of politics and coming from the inside of it to be more of a critique than to be directly involved. I think he would have been severely compromised if he'd won office, and we wouldn't have had all the great bon vivants that we have if he'd been in power.
Not only was he decades ahead of his time in confronting the bedrock, the horror, the real horror of American presidential politics, but of course he was openly gay from a very early time, when this was unprecedented.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he wrote The City and the Pillar in 1948 and sort of outed himself, wrote this openly gay novel.
And he's what? He's about 20, isn't he?
He was 23 years old. Right. He received a lot of resistance. The New York Times banned his books.
We've got to make this point. As a result of that book, he was not reviewed for years by the most powerful and influential newspaper in the country. He was targeted with that ferocity.
Absolutely. And I think he always wore that on his sleeve and was always very proud in a time when most people were very closeted. And strangely, that sort of moment when the New York Times did sort of blacklist him is what pushed him out to Hollywood, and that's when he started writing all those teleplays and got involved in sort of theatrical writing. And so I think it was a turning point in his life, and he even comments in the film that he decided right then that he was going to work and make money in Hollywood, and then he could write anything he wanted after he'd sort of established himself.
He was an admirer of Jack Kennedy as a person, but disillusioned with him as a president because of, well, lots of things, Bay of Pigs, Vietnam. And he doesn't take the view that Kennedy would have extracted the US from Vietnam. He thinks that's a piece of mythology. But he says in the film that Kennedy is a reminder to him not to be taken in by someone's charm. And he wasn't. And one of the strongest moments in your film comes towards the end, when he's watching Barack Obama's victory speech. And let's listen to what Gore has to say.
I would like to think of him as completely virtuous. I suspect he's not. Why do I suspect that? Because I know how politics works. If you need $10 million, more than what you've already raised to become the next president, you're going to get $10 million. And heaven knows what you're going to give away. Nothing as gross as Dr. Cheney's Halliburton, but they'd get something out of it, so they made up to him. Well, that just didn't happen because people liked the cut of his jib. It was not his jib that got them. Americans are farcical when faced with force majeure and money, two things that they worship. You can't expect a democracy from a society like this.
Yes, well, he goes further in his denunciation of his of country he loves than almost anyone I can think of.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you pointed that out, because some people say that, you know, claim that he didn't love the country, but he deeply did. And I think he was just so frustrated with the direction it had taken over his lifetime, and especially lately under the Bush administration. And then that moment, I was there with him at the Obama election, and there was so much hope in the air in the country in general. But he, some would say, took a cynical view, but really, from his point of view, a very realistic...
No, a skeptical view.
A skeptical view.
Not cynical. I don't think he was ever cynical.
No, I don't think he was cynical either, but people accuse him of that. And I think you're right. He was just skeptical that one man in that office of president really couldn't change anything and had to answer to the people that had got him there.
As I said, both Hitchens and Vidal often appeared on the program, and I have, I was very fond of Christopher, but we fell out, like almost everyone fell out with Christopher, over Iraq. It was the end of the very strong friendship between Vidal and Hitchens. In your conversations with him, did he regret that?
Did Hitchens regret it?
No, did Vidal regret that?
No, he had no regrets about that. And I you know, when I interviewed Hitchens, he kept coming back to ask me, you know, why wasn't Gore in touch with him and would he respond to this and would he see this interview? And he really wanted some kind of final conversation with Gore, or at least to have it out with him. And when I saw Gore and told him about the interview, he just shook his head and he had cut him off. He decided long before, when Hitchens made that right turn in support of the Iraq War, Gore just cut him off. He really saw him as a traitor to the cause and he had nothing more to do with him.
There are times when words are unnecessary, when all you have to do is look at that face. I can't think of a more marmoreal and astonishing face. It's, you know, it's not Mount Rushmore, it's anything but that. But it's so ravaged with time and age and illness and experience, yeah. A depth of perception.
Yeah, it's... I have a lot of close-ups in the film of Gore's face, and he's very old, and it's sort of warts and all, a lot of those moments with him. And I think, you know, but the gravitas of that man sitting there and speaking to the lens and speaking to us, it's sort of a warning going forward, I think. He really felt like he had to sort of get his word out, get this warning out. And I hope it's a sort of call to arms in a way. And what you mentioned earlier about young people, I hope they discover the film, because I think there's a lot of moments in the film that seem very timely even now and prescient.
Were there any topics off limits?
Well, the only thing that Gore wouldn't really answer to on camera was his personal life. He wouldn't speak much about it at all. And, you know, it wasn't my main priority. I wanted the film to be focused on his politics, really. But I would have loved him to speak a little bit more about his relationship with Howard and, you know, what went on and what his personal life was really like. But he liked to keep that very personal. That was his choice.
And yet, you know, there's tons in the film about his loves. The great loves of his life, and he doesn't deny at any point the nature of sexual relationships. But I'm glad that you didn't sort of obsess over that, because it's not the issue. To me, the issue very often is that we're seeing a time when public intellectuals could dominate American television. There he is having these brawls with Buckley, William F. Buckley Jr., the very famous encounters with Norman Mailer, and the masses of American, well, not the masses, but a huge number, are actually watching these conflicts. Wouldn't happen now.
No, you're right. I mean, those were prime time talk shows. He was on the Dick Cavett Show, the Johnny Carson Show, and, you know, his very acidic jokes about Reagan and so forth, and those debates, you know, the 1968 debates with William F. Buckley were huge moments in television at the time. These two patriarchs, one from the right and one from the left, going at
both aristocratic,
both aristocratic,
style, yeah.
Both very eloquent and both very witty and sort of able to stand toe-to-toe with each other and really go for it.
Did they secretly quite like each other?
Not at all.
Wasn't one of those?
No, it wasn't at all. I know there was a sort of litigation threats after that event when Gore calls Buckley a crypto-Nazi, and then Buckley responds by calling him a queer on national television in 1968. And they almost litigated, and there was never any reconciliation. They were not friends.
But, of course, he had such a wide circle of friends. There's Paul Newman, Tennessee Williams, Tim Robbins. You know, there's a long list of people, young people too.
All kinds of people used to go and visit him. And, you know, I was really surprised that going through the interviews and the research on who he knew, and it seemed that he knew everyone everywhere.
And like a very retentive memory. He could remember quite extraordinary facts about them.
Absolutely. He could remember, it seemed like, everything, the conversations he'd had 20 years before. If you'd bring up someone, he'd refer to a conversation he'd had with them and tell you in detail what they'd said and where they'd been. And it was remarkable. And, you know, I think he really loved people and really loved conversation. And that was his life, really.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there is an affection for people that you see. Even when he's doing book signings, yeah. There's a cordiality about him. It's not a chore. He interacts with warmth and friendship.
Absolutely, and I found that too. And I think a lot of people have the image that he's sort of this prickly, dry wit, you know, and that he's, and of course he could cut anyone down. He wouldn't suffer fools, but he was a generous, warm person as well.
Well, I hope that one of the things the documentary does is renew interest in the novels, particularly these novels on you know, on American political history, the books on the likes of Lincoln. These are very, very contrarian works, but God, they need to be reread.
Yeah, they're amazing. And I would actually recommend people maybe read Burr first, which is a fascinating book about the Founding Fathers and getting inside the characters of these people. And it really reads... it's a real sort of page-turner. You know, it's not something that people sort of think, oh, God, historical novel, that's going to be dry and boring, but they aren't at all. They're quite exciting to read.
Okay, he died in 2012, and the book, the film was bookended by shots of the plot where he planned to be buried next to his long-term companion, Howard. Why did you choose that way to open and end the film?
Well, it wasn't something we planned for. When I was in D.C. with Gore, I was talking to him about going to one of his old homes or school, and he wanted to go to Rock Creek Cemetery, which is where Howard was died. And then we ended up shooting this sort of almost Shakespearean scene of Gore standing yeah. over his own grave, this little soliloquy. And it just was...
All he needed was a skull for a Las Puyori.
Exactly.
Look, it's a great opening and a great ending, but the story of Gore Vidal has no ending, and I'm terribly pleased to have you on the program. Gore Vidal, The United States of Amnesia, limited release screenings in what are called selected cinemas throughout the month, but it will also be shown on ABC One on July the 27th on Sunday Arts Update. And I should point out that Nicholas Rathall has also written and made a terrific doco on boat people. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you.
LNL, and up next, a different sort of boat person, the so-called lucky Irish, the wild Irish convicts coming to Australia.